Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy, and we got out of the studio. We're back on the road.
Yeah.
Apologies to Willie Nelson. Woo. We're on the road again. We're at Signature Bank, their world headquarters in Rosemont. It's great to be back out, and we're promoting, in part, the good work that Signature Bank has done for the business community in Chicagoland, including this new business boost program that we rolled out yesterday. We talked a little bit about yesterday. $75,000 marketing spend that Signature Bank, in conjunction with our station AM 560, are putting together for one lucky business to help them, well, you know, get back to where they were pre-pandemic, or maybe even, to borrow a phrase, not a phrase I'll borrow often, build back better.
Oh, there you go.
How about that?
The business boost. And to get your business back on track or to take it to the next level, all you have to do is tell us how you've overcome the challenges of the last year and how this business boost could help you. So to enter, just go to 560theanswer.com/boost. That's 560theanswer.com/boost. Teams and terms and conditions apply, and entries must be submitted by August 1st. And this is, of course, presented by Signature Bank, which where we're at today, and their beautiful offices in Rosemont. This place is nice. It still smells new, too, doesn't it?
Well, and by the way, with respect to a Signature Bank and PPP, we've talked about it. We talked about it with their principals. 100% of their clients who applied for PPP, 100% of the PPP applications they processed for businesses in Chicagoland were fulfilled by the federal government. So they were on top of it from the beginning, and that kept the damage less than it otherwise would have been for the small to mid-sized business community in Chicago. I can tell you that. News out just yesterday that 40% of small businesses, 40% of small businesses destroyed. Study by Proceedings of the National Academies of Sciences, the shutdown orders made little to no difference on COVID's impact. And we've got other studies consistent with that from MIT and elsewhere that we've talked about. And 40%, 38.9% of small businesses, most of the providers of jobs in the country forced to close based on what? Based on government diktats.
Right.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line. This is as good a time as any to check in on small to mid-sized businesses in the greater Chicagoland area. And see how you're doing as we continue. I mean, if you walk around Chicago, meander through the downtown, you see a lot of empty storefronts. You're having more and more news of businesses filing Chapter 11, a big shopping mall concern that owns shopping malls in the Chicagoland area. Washington Prime just announced that yesterday. And so just in the combination of trying to recover from the lockdowns and trying to recover from the government policies that are keeping so many workers on the sidelines, where you're at, if you're a small business owner operator, or if you're somebody who works for one of these privately held concerns, small to mid-sized business, just be interesting to check in, since we're here at ground zero with one of the great providers of assistance to small to mid-sized businesses in Chicago.
And it's part of the reason why you can't reopen fully is because you can't find employees. I mean, there are so many businesses, and I'm sure you've seen the signs, Dan, that are, offering bonuses. And $50, I went to a gas station the other day, $50 just to fill out an application. for not even to take the job, just to apply for the job, they're offering money. I never thought we'd see that in our lifetime, but are you having problems finding employees? 312-642-5600, turnkey.proanswerline, 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
More than half the businesses in leisure and hospitality destroyed.
Oh, my God.
States hardest hit were those dependent on those industries, California, Florida, New York, D.C. And it's remarkable how lethargic, though, except for Florida, California, New York, and Washington, D.C. are. And it's remarkable, too, Florida not lethargic, how Ron DeSantis was able to minimize the damage there by taking the light touch approach and following the science and data as compared to California and New York. I mean, Florida's unemployment rate, a fraction of what California, New York, and Illinois, if you want to throw them in, experiencing.
And California, by the way, is mask-free today, if you've been vaccinated. I don't know if that's going to help with their business climate, but they're trying to get back to normal. And I think Gavin Newsom realizes his job's on the line, and so many people have lost their livelihoods that he had to make an about-face.
Yeah, unfortunately, I don't think Gavin Newsom is going to be a political casualty in this, although he richly deserves to be. Our friend Casey Mulligan and a colleague of his, E.J. Antoni, writing in the Wall Street Journal, the pay is generous, the work non-existent. The federal employment bonus was a bad idea to begin with. It needs to go post-haste. And this is, they talk about as the predicate what we're talking about. More than a million jobs waiting to be filled in construction, manufacturing. But these industries have gained almost no new employees over the past 2 months. And we're talking about high-paying blue-collar jobs, as we've talked about before. When Casey Mulligan warned on these pages back in December of the negative effects of the $300 bonus in unemployment benefits, he was criticized as exaggerating it. When you start to total up all of the benefits to be conferred by the federal government, when with the child tax credits and so on and so forth, you have a benefits package from the state that's six figures. So it's not just looking at the $300 in isolation and saying, oh, it's just $300. It's looking at the expanse of dependency programs, of transfer payments that the government, federal government in particular, with support from particularly blue state governments, have put together to keep people on the sidelines. They point out, in 21 states and D.C., households can receive the equivalent wage of $25 an hour in benefits with no one working.
Why would you ever leave your house? Especially if you had kids and you'd have to pay for daycare.
The idea of, it's just the minimum wage. I saw Bernie Sanders saying the tipped minimum wage has been at $2.13 for 30 years. Right. Well, in half the country, $25 an hour with benefits, $25 an hour in benefits to stay home. In 19 states, benefits are equivalent, as I was saying, of $100,000 a year in salary for a family of four with two unemployed parents. In all but two of the blue states, the $300 supplemental employment insurance can benefit, plus other welfare can pay more than the wage equivalent of $15 an hour. Part of this is, I think, our fault, Republicans' fault, just focusing on this one aspect of government largesse, of this dependency trap that they erected to provide their alibi for the lockdowns, when you have to look at it in totality. This is what's keeping people on the sidelines, and it's part of what is putting small businesses on the sidelines permanently. Dan and Amy coming to you live from Signature Bank on this Tuesday morning.
Hear about the big stories of the day, then talk about them right here on Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Let freedom ring this afternoon at 2 with Sean Hannity on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. We're coming to you live from Signature Bank, their global headquarters in Rosemont, Illinois. And not part of our Signature Bank business tour. Hopefully we'll do that again sometime. But this is the Business Boost joint between AM 560 and Signature Bank.
Yeah, and if you own a business, listen up, because we want to give a local business a marketing package. And this is unlike anything else. This is valued at $75,000. $75,000. So we want you to, a lucky winner, to use this boost to get your business back on track, take it to the next level, recover after a year of draconian lockdowns. And all you have to do is tell us how you've overcome the challenges of this last year and how the business boost could help you. So to enter, listen up, go to 560theanswer.com/boost. That's 560theanswer.com/boost. And terms and conditions apply, but entries must be submitted by August 1st. And this is presented by our good friends here at Signature Bank.
All right. So as we were talking about before, Mike Scott's news, 40% of small businesses wiped out by the lockdowns. Same for a year and a half of school for most kids from K through 12 through college. We have studies out in recent weeks from MIT, from the National Academies of Sciences, from the University of Munich, indicating lockdowns did little to nothing to change the trajectory of the virus. So that's your backdrop. Now comes Andy Slavitt, who is the foul-mouthed Biden COVID czar, outgoing, because it's time to cash in. He's got a book out called Preventable, and he was on CBS hawking his book and telling us, you know what the problem is? You know what the problem is with you people?
What?
I got a lot of problems with you people on behalf of Andy Slavitt. Didn't sacrifice enough.
I think we all need to look at one another and ask ourselves, what do we need to do better next time? And in many respects, being able to sacrifice a little bit for one another to get through this and to save more lives is going to be essential, and that's something that I think we could all have done a little bit better on.
So when we look in the mirror and evaluate our own role in all this, the public, how we could have sacrificed more, as you say, and we think about the possibility of a difficult fall or winter or a difficult variant, what more needs to be done now to prepare ourselves as a public, putting aside the government and the scientific part of this? For us as the public, what's the message?
Well, there's a couple simple things. One is that all the people that for so long live so close to the edge, that don't have a great safety net, that don't have great health insurance, but they're forced to work day in and day out to serve us. They're growing crops. They're delivering food to our warehouses. They're working in grocery stores. They're delivering food to our door. All those people are at risk all the time. And so there's a chapter in the book called The Room Service Pandemic, and it talks about how a lot of us had it quite okay during the pandemic and others didn't. So we should be looking at that. And then, look, preventing the spread of the disease is really about a couple simple things. Not breathing near one another in large spaces. That's really it, if you want to be overly simple about it. And that requires a certain amount of sacrifice and change. It's a short period of time, and we none of us can do it forever, and it's not pleasant. But when we do, we reduce the amount of spread pretty dramatically. And if the variants come back in the fall, as they will, the people who are unvaccinated really are going to need to pay serious attention to that and consider getting vaccinated, because we have some great...
All right, so there it is. People need to be freed from being, quote unquote, forced to work. I love that phraseology. Forced to work, you know, forced to make a living. You need to be freed from that, because other people like Andy Slavitt are able to make a living without producing anything. And so everybody should be able to live like Andy Slavitt. Were that we could, Andy. Unfortunately, America would be a lot less interesting and dynamic place if everybody was Andy Slavitt. Thankfully, they're not. But forced to work, so expand the welfare state, incentivize people not to work. You know, don't breathe on people in large spaces. Actually, yeah. Andy, I know you're the COVID czar, but my understanding is that most of the transmission was in small spaces in people's homes when they were locked down. Is that not correct?
Yeah. I mean, what we could have done better, many of us took a pay cut. That's if we kept our jobs in the first place. Kids were isolated, depressed, suicide rates through the roof, suicide attempts up 42% from last year.
Suicides as well.
What we could have done better. I mean, well, the original sin is that they sorted all jobs and institutions and businesses into essential and non-essential. That was the original sin. And then after we suffered and we watched our kids suffer firsthand, he comes back and what we could have done better.
What are you willing to do when the variants come in the fall and Andy Slavitt says, hey, can you give a little bit more?
Can you stop breathing?
It's for a short period of time, breathing in large spaces, you know, 2 weeks to slow the spread, a year and a half. I mean, these are rounding errors when it comes to government. 2 weeks, a month, 3 months, a year and a half, the next decade, your entire life. Rounding errors. They're trying to perfect us, and it's not easy having to deal with us. And so could you give Andy Slavitt a hand, for God's sakes? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro, text line. Maybe, you know, maybe you have to make a Sophie's choice.
I got a text
message.
Maybe
not everybody gets on the lifeboat.
Oh, yeah, you're right. Text message, I sacrificed a 20-year career, a possible book deal, a good bit of sanity. My spouse took a huge pay cut for 6 months in an executive position and physically went into work every workday. Kids gave up real school, friends, activities, emotional health. Yet it's not enough for Andy Slavitt.
I hear what you're saying, but couldn't you do a little bit more? I got the list, but I don't know. Couldn't you?
Maybe should I stop breathing if I'm in a large crowd? That was his suggestion.
Maybe throw up some solar panels on the roof. Buy a Tesla. I mean,
should
can't
I
you
put
do
a wind
something?
Farm in my backyard?
Something.
My 8x6 foot space.
Maybe take in a teacher who's frightened. Why don't you feed a teacher?
They're still out there, by the way.
Feed one
those
of these
vaccinated teachers are still afraid to go back to work.
When they come back from
beautiful people,
you know, their resort vacations in Mexico, you know, maybe take them in as a boarder and just nurse them back to health. Huh? You can't reach out, help a teacher, help a politician, the real people who suffered in this, a school board member, maybe. The heroes I'm talking about.
The ones that were remote learning from Florida and California. And I did see somebody from Whitney Young in Hawaii remote learning because she was too afraid to teach, but not afraid to fly.
It's not just Andy Slavitt. And this turns out to be really important because, as been mourning for months, they're going to try to rewrite the history of the COVID response like they try to rewrite American history writ large. They need to rewrite that history because they have so much culpability for so many, being generous, mistakes that were made, being too generous. But let's just call them mistakes.
Yeah.
And the implications of the choices that public health officials and politicians and this little dance that they did together. Those choices, the consequences of them versus the benefits of them as more and more investigations are indicating. They have a problem. They need an alibi. They need to come out of this with everybody excited that, hey, we've got some of our freedoms back from the government. Your freedoms don't come from the government. Never mind that. So they're going to tell the story of what we did and some mistakes were made and we're going to learn from them. But here are the mistakes that we need to focus on. Inequities. You heard Andy Slavitt. The welfare state's not big enough. You could do more, middle-income America, who sort of more or less got by, many of you. And for those who didn't, so sorry. You're going to have to continue to make the case, and we're here to provide you all the information to make that case, because it's a strong one. As I said, it's not just the czar here. It's also Western leaders like Bojo. Listen to what Boris Johnson had to say at the G7. About the lessons to take away from COVID-19. Not exactly, by the way, a heroic performance from Bojo either.
No.
Let's not.
Extended their lockdown now 3 more weeks because of this Delta virus.
Don't fall in love with that guy just because he has a Trump's haircut, okay?
We've all been going through the most wretched pandemic our countries have faced for our lifetimes, maybe longer, much longer. And I actually think this is a meeting that genuinely needs to happen because we need to make sure that we learn the lessons from the pandemic. We need to make sure that we don't repeat some of the errors that we doubtless made in the course of the last 18 months or so. And I think what's gone wrong with this pandemic, or what risks being a lasting scar, is that I think the inequalities may be entrenched, and we need to make sure that as we recover, we level up across our societies and we build back better, and building back greener, and building back fairer, and building back more equal and in a more gender neutral and perhaps like a more feminine way. How about that? Apart from anything else.
What? What does feminism have to do with COVID?
We need to build back better in a more feminine way. Speak for yourself, Boris. I'm sticking with this package. Okay? I don't know what he has.
He got himself covered over there.
I don't know what he has in mind. But, I mean, but listen to that pablum from Boris Johnson.
Gosh.
Fair, green, equity. These are the lessons from the pandemic. Not government overreach, not junk science, not fear-mongering, not lying. No, those aren't the lessons. Their agenda is always the lesson. And your lack of sacrificing in advance of their agenda, you could always give a little bit more to be greener, fairer, and more feminine. Apparently.
More feminine. 312-642-5600 turnkey.pro answer line 64636. Type in DA and then a quick comment. But you talk about controlling the narrative. New York City, they're gonna hold a ticker tape parade. This is what Dr. Nzeke wanted, remember? When it's all over, when 70% of the population has been vaccinated and, you know, hospitalizations are down, we're going to have a parade. They're having a parade July 7th, just in case you want to make your travel plans now.
Yeah.
They're going to be celebrating frontline heroes as well, and it'll march up the legendary canon of heroes. Very significant sign of recovery, according to Bill de Blasio.
Are they, with de Blasio and nipple rings, statues going up?
Oh.
I mean, we're going to celebrate de Blasio and Cuomo and what a great job that they did, right?
But what makes me mad is Andy Slavitt, Cuomo, Dr. Fauci, they're all profiting off of this pandemic, which is wrong on a number of levels. They're making millions of dollars off of this.
Well, they're right. They're profiting through book deals. Yeah. But in addition, the politics of this, too. I say so just in case, you know, you're not buying my argument. Cuomo and de Blasio are having a parade to celebrate themselves in the state that arguably handled COVID the worst.
The death capital of America.
Certainly, there's no question about that. And
that's a slap in the face for all the people who lost loved ones during COVID, especially nursing homes.
Well, exactly.
And nursing homes. I'm like, I'm going to a parade. Are you kidding me? I'd bring tomatoes.
The nursing home scandal in New York, the unbelievable statements and some actions in furtherance of those statements by Warren Wilhelm, a.k.a. de Blasio, you either shut down your Saturday synagogue services or I'll shut down the synagogues altogether. Remember that little offering from de Blasio?
And now he's
in consideration of your First Amendment rights. Remember, that's part of this discussion, too, is those freedoms that were sacrificed and the understanding of the origins of those freedoms that were sacrificed by so many. And now de Blasio and Cuomo are going to throw a parade for themselves. Dan and Amy coming to you live from Signature Bank.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy coming to you live from Signature Bank. Kicking off our business boost promotion. We were talking about all things COVID-related and building back better, greener, fairer, and more feminine, according to Bojo. And let's throw Andy Slavitt onto that as well. Tom in Oswego, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. I'll tell you, these politicians drive me crazy. They almost make me sick. They sit up there on their perch with lifetime benefits and all types of six-figure pensions, guaranteed salaries, while us peons out here who aren't sacrificing enough, and I'm a small contractor of 32 years, this has been the toughest year to find any seasonal help. And Dan, I think I've said this before, but I think what's going to happen is as all these employers are paying these high salaries, the restaurant owners, who I know quite a few of, once things start to level out, 5 months, 6 months, seven, whatever it is, they're going to be stuck with those high salaries. And also the cost of goods aren't going to come down as fast. Things are going to slow down really fast once we start to level off. Right now, we've just got the inertia of the economy picking up and starting up. And so everybody's excited working 70, 80 hours a week. But once we start to level off, that's when we're going to start to hit some really bad bumps.
Well, thanks for the call, Tom. Some of us working 70 and 80 hours a week. I mean, not me.
Oh, but maybe Tom.
Tom sounds like he is.
And we appreciate your hard work. You work hard at your golf game.
But the Tom's, that's true. Tom's out there busting his hump.
Yeah.
So that he can pay for people to freeload.
Where do I sign up for that?
It's a great system you got set up if you're not Tom. Mark in Rochelle.
Yeah, I just seem to sense a pattern that these guys who make these statements like this are given a list of trigger words and are told that you hit as many of these as you can, and if we can make people scared or angry, trigger that, then we can control them. It's been a pattern for years.
Thanks for the call, Mark.
They've mastered that. I mean, they scared people into submission.
Well, the stringing together of the buzzwords, it's just remarkable to me, I suppose, that they believe they can get away with having a constituency only consisting of sentimental barbarians. Those are the only people they need to serve. The lobotomized leftists who just receive and regurgitate either, bromides or literally just the Orwellian newspeak vocabulary. That's all they have to say. They don't have to make an argument. They don't have to lay out a case. They don't have to answer questions. They just have to say equity, feminine, build back, fairness, but like Bojo did.
Yeah.
It's really remarkable. There's got to be a market opportunity there somewhere. Maybe conservatives need to figure out what that is.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Morning Answer.
On AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. We're coming to you live from Signature Bank in Rosemont at their HQ this morning, kicking off our Signature Bank Business Boost promotion, which is a cool thing. $75,000 marketing spend for one marketing package.
Yeah.
For one lucky business. And how do interested participants apply, Amy?
Well, Dan, all you have to do is tell us how you've overcome the challenges of this last year and how the business boost, which again, $75,000, could help you. So pay attention. To enter, just go to 560theanswer.com/boost. That's 560theanswer.com/boost. And, all the information is there. But, tell us again how you've overcome the challenges of this year and how you need this money to continue the longevity of your business. Entries must be submitted by August 1st. And again, it is presented by Signature Bank. Very nice of them. Very generous.
We've been talking all morning about COVID and the takeaways and the lessons to be learned, because if we're not talking about what happened, what we understand to be true, then you can be sure that COVIDian goons, the lockdowners, are going to intercede as they are to try to rewrite the history, to absolve themselves of responsibility for the choices that they made, politicians, public health officials, etc., and the members of the public that support them, try and absolve themselves and set the predicate to do it again. So we better have our facts straight, and this necessarily implicates the D.C. press corps. Matt Purple, our friend over at the American Conservative, has a good write-up on the media. Everyone understands the Soviet Union tried to cover up the Chernobyl disaster, but what's less known is they'd already pulled it off once before. In 1957, an accident at a plutonium production site near the remote city of Kishtin in the Ural Mountains saw the spread of radioactive particles for tens of thousands of square miles across the USSR. Nearby population centers were evacuated, slowly. But it wasn't until the late 70s that a defector began to reveal the true scope of the incident. Got away with it for two decades. The Soviets, as should be apparent, were not the first people you'd want watching over your nuclear reactor. Still, you have to hand it to the commies. At least when they lied, they were acting in the interest of their own glorious motherland. It never would have occurred to them to cover up the truth about a deadly emergency on behalf of a rival power, which is what we had the D.C. press corps do. That's such an elegantly simple way to put it. At least if you're going to lie, protect your own country. This is lying to protect Chinese communists.
Lying to protect our enemies?
That's what the D.C. press corps did, didn't they? Let that sink in for a minute. New York Magazine. This is their fallback position. David Wallace Wells writing in New York Magazine, the implications of the lab leak hypothesis. Listen to this paragraph. On the lab leak, practically speaking, the media as a whole is already there, having moved in just a few weeks quite close to acting as though it's true. A sign that the Trump era of American political epistemology may be mercifully receding, with liberal and center-left publications feeling now much freer to consider possibilities the president had once made functionally unthinkable. Now you can consider the lab leak hypothesis because Trump is gone. Huh?
And we can use hydroxychloroquine, too. Thanks.
Center-left publications, which, by the way, is a generous description, feeling now much freer to consider possibilities the president had once made functionally unthinkable. We couldn't consider it because we had to get Trump out of office. We couldn't consider what was true and what wasn't. We didn't have time for that. Now that he's gone, we can revisit these issues that we purposely lied about or refused to consider in light of any evidence because our focus was on taking Trump out. So all means necessary, ends justify the means. We can only report the story that the virus did not originate in the Wuhan lab because Trump suggested that it did. If Trump had suggested it was an animal-to-human transfer, then we would have only reported the possibility that it occurred in the lab, you see. Because whatever Trump said, if Trump said the sun set in the west, we would have to say there's no proof of that. We think that the sun sets in the east. Because Trump made it functionally impossible for us to consider what is true. Does that sound like a very good defense for the Fourth Estate's behavior?
They're just trying to cover their you-know-whats.
Well, I know what they're trying to do, but that's a remarkable statement. The truth, considering what is true, I will repeat for emphasis, to penetrate people's consciousness, turn this around, please. To consider what is true, to go where the facts lead, was functionally unthinkable, that phrase, under Trump, according to one of the luminaries at New York Magazine. Now that he's gone, we can revisit what is true.
Who the heck do these people think they are? Oh, my God. Get off your high horse and do your job, regardless of who's president. 312-642-5600. Turnkey.pro answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
Bob in Buffalo Grove.
Thanks for taking my call, Amy and Dan. One of the biggest scandals I hope starts to be resolved is the failure to use hydroxychloroquine. Yeah. I just heard a report we could have saved over 100,000 lives if it would have been used as a
therapeutic.
The media was compliant in this because Trump said to use it and that. Trump is bad, so anything he says is bad. It's just amazing how, into the future, how this whole story is going to be rewritten and the facts are going to come out with regards to the media spinning this in the wrong direction.
Thanks.
Yeah, remember Dr. Fauci?
Thanks for the call, Bob.
Poo-pooed hydroxychloroquine. Like, well, maybe it works. Maybe it doesn't. I'm not sure. I couldn't stand him.
This was a study that's out just this last week, suggesting that using hydroxychloroquine and azithromycin improves survival by as much as 200% among hospitalized COVID-19 patients who received invasive medical ventilation. Not been finalized by authors and so on and so forth, all the qualifications, but it is interesting given how uniformly it was dismissed by our betters. Also, and perhaps even more importantly, there are now about 20 randomized clinical trials of ivermectin for COVID. They overwhelmingly show reductions in mortality when used in adequate doses and in patients who are in early enough stages of the disease. 20 randomized clinical trials of ivermectin.
So we have proven therapeutics that will help us if we get COVID. So why then the big push for all the vaccines?
Well, that's a right. That's the salient question. There's no that is the salient question. But this media piece, too, I mean, and this is part of the media conversation, is the questions they won't ask, the topics that they won't undertake. I mean, they're functionally unthinkable until they're not. They're functionally unthinkable because it's politics first for us. Are the right people in office? Are the right people being amplified? Are the right people being silenced? Once we have the landscape set, then we can think about those things that are functionally unthinkable until the landscape is set. I mean, I just...
You're so telling.
Functionally unthinkable.
I've never heard that before.
Jerry Baker, our friend Gerard Baker, writing the Wall Street Journal on the topic, too. Jeffrey Toobin and the 1619 Project and the journalistic reign of error. Reign of terror, too, I would say. Or certainly flacking for those who are doing some approximation of the reign of terror. The Toobin riff is pretty good. These days of proliferating lapses in journalists' judgment and standards are not simply forgiven by the editorial establishment. They're rewarded as long as they are the right kind of error by the right kind of person. Medium is no longer the message. The new reality is that the mission is the message. As long as your work furthers the mission, no failure in behavior, including public masturbation, mm-hmm. no error in reporting or editing, no corruption of the truth or evidence will go unrewarded. Unrewarded. Not unpunished. Will not go unrewarded. Will go unpunished and will go rewarded.
Well, did you hear what happened in Texas? In Austin, remember that man went and shot 13 people, too critical, over the weekend? The Statesman newspaper refused to publish the description of the man who was still on the loose because, quote, it could be harmful to perpetuating stereotypes.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have we have a vague description at this point, so we're going to refrain from putting out what we know because it could be harmful.
I wonder.
Are you kidding me? They just didn't want to say that he was African American.
Oh, I presume that they were afraid he was wearing a MAGA hat, and so they didn't want to perpetuate a stereotype about Trump voters.
Wrong.
Right.
Yeah.
The mission is the message.
It's unbelievable. I mean, that is their responsibility. There is a gunman on the loose who plowed down or mowed down with a gun 15 people in total, and they refused because they were afraid of offending him, of offending a gunman. The madman.
The mission is the message. The mission is the message. Understand this. Key point. Don and McHenry.
Hey, good morning, Dan and Amy. I just mentioned to you guys a couple weeks ago, maybe Don from Dallas-Fort Worth, soon the house goes on the market. So I'm going to be one of those stats of people leaving Illinois. So I wanted to share that first. One more.
Congratulations.
Download the mobile app.
Thank you. Thank you.
And congratulations on your new and improved life. Yes.
You can still listen to us.
I can't wait. But Dan and Amy, this article that you just referenced, Dan, is just astounding. I can't even believe the honesty of it. But
yes.
You know, a lot of times people act like, oh, bad things can't happen in America and things of this nature. I mean, I hear what you just said, and I think this is just absolute proof that the mentality of many people on the left is it is okay for people to die as long as we stay in power. I mean, I don't know how else to look at it any other way.
Me neither. Thanks for the call, Don.
We're not going to investigate the truth because we don't like who the president is.
The ends justify the means. I mean, that's the rationale of those who use other people as means to their ends. And if people become inconvenient, then they're conveniently dispatched. It's pretty serious business when you look at this through the lens of decisions related to people's livelihoods and lives during the pandemic, isn't it? I mean, it's one thing when it's just esoteric, like, oh, one politician is getting unfair coverage versus another politician, or they're not covering this debate about tax policy fairly and so on and so forth. How about when it's lives and livelihoods on the line? Jerry on I-55.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. I received 2 doses of hydroxychloroquine along with plasma at a hospital in Florida. It took me 6 days to get better. I can't understand why other hospitals wouldn't prescribe that.
Thanks for the
call,
Jerry.
I'm glad you're feeling better.
Yeah. Cassandra in Ravenswood.
Good morning. Isn't this good news? This is an open admission,
yeah,
and a poignant and honest admission that quote-unquote journalists are no more than agitation propagandists. They're willing to take part in an influence campaign, or they're admitting that they're suffering from Trump derangement syndrome, or both. I think this is somewhat good news. It proves everybody who's been, and let's not whine, this has been going on since the 70s in Watergate. Let's remember that the Democrat bugged the Republican committee headquarters as well. I mean, this has been going on for a long time. It's gotten worse since the 90s when we became a Sovietized party, which I'm embarrassed I didn't leave until the beginning of the century. But it's gotten worse and worse. And what's astonishing is that these people think this is okay.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
I get the people on our local news that are getting paid millions of dollars to read what's on the teleprompter, no matter what kind of nonsense it is.
Mm-hmm.
That they're protecting their phony baloney jobs and income.
Yes.
But that they're proud of this is a little surprising.
Thanks for the call, Cassandra. Glad you made the change. Happy to have you. More people need to be
more
like Cassandra,
yes.
I guess. But no, you're right. It is a happy event that you get that admission in New York Magazine.
Yeah, I was shocked when you're reading it.
But it's also telling that, and it speaks to what Jerry Baker is writing about in the Wall Street Journal, that journalist over at the New York Magazine knows he's going to be rewarded. By the way, I mean, Dave Remnick at The New Yorker, at the outset of Trump administration, you know, all the old rules of journalism are suspended because we have to get Trump out of office is effectively what he said. Not direct quote, but that's effectively what he said. So they're out and proud about it because there are no consequences. You know, people respond to incentives. This is why, I mean, going back to what we were talking about last hour, it's remarkable that Boris Johnson and other politicians in the West think they can just repeat back woke slogans to the woke. And that's all that those are the only people they need to cater to. Those are the only people they need to address. It's sort of an indictment of sensible center right people, isn't it? What we're not doing, what we're not demanding, what we're tolerating. Brian in Oak Forest.
Good morning, guys.
Morning.
Every single morning, you guys bring up an example of why I make my own tank tops, T-shirts, and hoodies that say big, bold, media, CNN font that says Muskopedia, and I wear them proudly. Thank you.
Thanks, Brian. Greg in Jefferson Park.
Hey, Greg, are you there?
Was caught on Michigan Avenue with some ghost guns, and they arrested her. And, of course, guns, how they can't be traced, and you can make them using 3D printers and so on. And that they basically came to light and are used by a lot of criminals now, in particular in Chicago and the South and West Sides, but were brought into being by white supremacists. So I guess all the, you know, all the minority gangs. Good one.
Thanks for the call, Greg.
Getting phone calls while he's talking to us.
What? Oh, he is? Is that why he's cutting out? Well, so he's basically saying
he's a busy
that,
man.
You know, the problem with the street gang violence in Chicago is white supremacy. That's part of the messaging. Well, it's the part of the messaging you get from Triple Threat, too. Yeah, Systemic racism. That's the source of the gang violence in Chicago. Of course it is. You know, the problem in Chicago is all the white conservatives in charge of everything.
It's people like you, Dan.
There's no question.
Living downtown, they want you out.
No question. And until people like me are out of Chicago, it's functionally unthinkable to think otherwise. Dan and Amy, coming to you from Signature Bank.
Listen to podcast of Dan and Amy from the AM 560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. Let freedom ring this afternoon at 2 with Sean Hannity on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy, and we're coming to you live this morning from Signature Bank at their headquarters in Rosemont, kicking off our business boost promotion, which we'll talk about again in a bit. But now it's time to talk about K-12 education and critical race theory. Michael Rivera is a parent in Loudoun County, Virginia. Let's go back to Loudoun County, Virginia. I love that this has become ground zero for this fight because both sides are digging in.
Yeah, and everything, first for COVID, now for critical race theory.
This is important because it's presenting both sides together. And so people can watch this play out, hear the arguments and the quality of the intellect behind those arguments, and make their own decision in terms of who is standing in a sensible place and who isn't. There's not enough debates like this in this country right now. So it's great to have this play out the way that it is. Michael Rivera. I like to stay home. I don't necessarily like to spend my time at school board meetings, but we have to do it. He has two children in the school. They happen to be biracial. He's a Latino gentleman. He married a white chick. His daughter has special needs. I don't subscribe to identity politics, says Mr. Rivera, but since I married a wonderful woman who happens to be white, my son is white, my daughter tends to favor her Hispanic heritage. According to critical race theory, my son should have white guilt and white privilege simply because of the color of his skin. And Mr. Rivera isn't having it. He's not having it. And more parents getting hip to what's been going on in K-12 education for some time aren't having it either. One of them is Keisha King. She's down in Duval County, Florida. She recently addressed the Florida State Board of Education before they made their decision on critical race theory. Here's what Ms. King had to say.
Good morning. Thank you for having me speak. My name is Keisha King. I'm a mom of two, one who's in the Duval County public school system and one in private school thanks to school choice. I'm also a member of Moms for Liberty, representing thousands of parents. Just coming off of May 31st, marking the 100 years of the Tulsa riots, it is sad that we are even contemplating something like critical race theory, where children will be separated by their skin color and deemed permanently oppressors or oppressed in 2021. That is not teaching the truth, unless you believe that whites are better than blacks. I have personally heard teachers teaching CRT, and we have had an assembly shut down because Duval County Public School System consultant thought it would be a great idea to separate students by race. This is unacceptable. CRT is not racial sensitivity or simply teaching unfavorable American history or teaching Jim Crow history. CRT is deeper and more dangerous than that. CRT, in its outworking today, is a teaching that there is a hierarchy in society where white, male, heterosexual, able-bodied people are deemed the oppressor, and anyone else outside of that status is oppressed. That's why we see corporations like Coca-Cola asking their employees to be less white, which is ridiculous. I don't know about you, but telling my child or any child that they are in a permanent oppressed status in America because they are black is racist, and saying that white people are automatically above me, my children, or any child is racist as well. This is not something that we can stand for in our country. And don't take it from me. Look at the writers of these types of publications. Our ancestors, white, black, and others, hung, bled, and died right alongside each other to push America towards that more perfect union. If this continues, we will look back and be responsible for the dismantling of the greatest country in the world by reverting to teaching hate and that race is a determining factor on where your destiny lies. Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am.
Yeah, that deserves a round of applause, I'd say. For more, we're pleased to be joined by Keisha King, member of Moms for Liberty and mother of two down there in Florida. Keisha, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, that was a well-received speech, as well as it should have been. And ultimately, you won the day, and to those who believe like you do and we do, which is a critical race theory is not going to be a part of curriculum in the state of Florida.
Yes, we had a victory. It was banned. We just have to make sure that we keep our eye on the school board, because I believe that they will try to find a way to incorporate it in the curriculum.
By how? What do you mean?
I don't want to speak too much on it until I see the actual curriculum, the official curriculum coming out. But what they've been doing all along is that it hasn't been official curriculum. What they've been doing is weaving it into the curriculum, you know, that's on the books that they are already going to be teaching. So to me, it becomes a question of how do we monitor and make sure that they're not teaching this to our children.
And I like the way that you came at it, too, because I think that's the right way. The idea that this what you're teaching is that whites are superior to blacks. What you're teaching is that the black man or woman cannot do anything in this country without the white man. And what kind of sense does that make? How is that empowering for black Americans?
Right. It's insulting. It's saying flat out that we cannot do anything else, just like you said, unless it's sanctioned by a white male, or, you know, it's ridiculous and it's insulting. I don't understand why that's hard to understand.
How did you receive it when Joe Biden said, you know, the problem that black Americans have in terms of starting businesses and so forth is they can't find an accountant or a lawyer?
I was just insulted at hearing that I was approved by a white person to know that I'm not oppressed in society. He has constantly said things that are demoralizing and puts black people less than other people in this country. We have documented history of saying flat out racist statements.
Yeah. And what made you decide, like, what was your breaking point to make you decide to go in front of the school board? Because that takes a lot of courage.
I've been speaking about this throughout the last couple of weeks at our school board meetings. And I've just had it. I have had it with these officials, pushing this stuff on our children. It seems they are relentless. They don't have any way of letting up. And it's time that we vote them out. It's time that more parents start speaking up and paying attention to what and pushed upon our children. And it's not just for black Hispanics and, I guess what we call others. It's a white. All have to stand up and come against this.
You mentioned in your remarks to the State Board of Education down there in Florida that one of your kids is in private school thanks to school choice. How much of a game changer has school choice been for your family, as well as, you know, your perspective on Florida in general?
Oh, my gosh. It has been tremendous. My youngest daughter is a special needs child. She's a wonderful little human being, and we were really struggling with her in public school. And I searched and searched, went through tons of meetings, fought back and forth with the district about what they were telling her that, the types of courses that she needed to take that weren't really benefiting her. And I was blessed to live here in Florida where we do have school choice. The moment I got, you know, the opportunity to put her on that waiting list for this wonderful private school, I did. And she got in there and she has thrived. She did not speak out loud when she was in public school. She spoke in a whisper on her very first day at this private school. So that just goes to show you what a transformation this has been to our family.
And what kind of support have you been getting from your community? Were people pleased by what you did? Did you get any pushback from anyone?
You know, surprisingly, I do. I mean, yes, you do get pushback, but I was very surprised that in the black community, I got emails and messages on Facebook and people saying, you know, good job, from people that I, you know, probably would not have thought agreed with me. So it's been both, you know, sides agreeing and not agreeing, but I do see a lot of people agreeing.
You know, we've had this discussion before. I'd like to get your take on it. So you know, I'm definitely on board with everything that you said and where you're coming from. But the banning of critical race theory, I don't want to get into the banning of things when it comes to this sort of poison, intellectual poison. I want to take this stuff on straight away. So my perspective is to say, oh, you want to teach critical race theory? You want the kids to read White Fragility? You want them to read How to Be an Anti-Racist? No problem. But they're also going to have to read John McWhorter, and they're also going to have to read Shelby Steele. And those views are going to be brought into this as well, because I want John McWhorter and Shelby Steele to do intellectual battle with Ibram Kendi and Robin DiAngelo. You know what I'm saying? I want to defeat them. I don't want to drive them underground and, like you were saying, for them to find a way to insinuate themselves in other classes and not be part of the formal curriculum. I want the battle to be in the center of the ring, and let's hash it out.
You know, I love that perspective, and I want children to be able to see, you know, different perspectives on all things as well. Just with caution, because the schools and the teachers' unions and these school board members, they are so fixated on this one-sided view that I just don't honestly trust them to bring in other sides of the argument. I just don't trust them to do it. So at this point, you know, because our children are so vulnerable, you know, their minds are so moldable, if we have to ban it to save the children, for, you know, just canceling people and banning things. And I understand exactly what you're saying. I just, you know, but I don't want to risk my kid or anybody's child, you know, being this pushed upon them, and they grow up believing that, you know, that they are in a state of oppression that they can't escape.
Right. I mean, I understand. Yeah. I understand they need to have a sense of urgency about this, because your kids are in school right now and you want that education to be exactly something that reflects your values. No, I get that, too. I don't think it's an easy call. You're a member of this group called Moms for Liberty. Just because, you know, here in Chicagoland, a lot of people are beaten down. There's some pushback happening. But I wonder how your group formed, just as maybe an example for how other groups can form similarly in districts here where we are in Chicagoland and frankly, around the country.
Yes, so it was started by a few moms, one of them being Tina Deskovic, and they just, you know, same thing. They got tired of all of the policies that these superintendents were forcing upon our children. And so they started a group of just parents who were sick and tired of the overreach, especially with the masking and the, you know, the critical race theory and, you know, just overreaching of teaching, you know, things about sexual orientation that some of these children are just too young, you know, to be worried about those kinds of things. And they were tired, and so they started this wonderful group, Moms for Liberty, and people can check us out at momsforliberty.org. And they got together and started fighting back, and now we have chapters all over the nation.
All right, it's time for Moms for Liberty chapter in Lakeview, Amy, and some other places around Chicagoland. She is Keisha King, member of Moms for Liberty, as she was describing, mother of two down there in Florida. Keisha, congratulations. Best of luck and continued success for your kids and Moms for Liberty down in Duval County. We appreciate your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. And she joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one. Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
And Amy, we're coming to you live from Signature Bank, their headquarters in Rosemont this morning. And we're launching our business boost joint with Signature Bank. And Amy, tell them what they could win.
Well, Dan, thank you very much.
My best Wink Martindale.
Now, if you own or run a small or mid-sized business and you really need to listen up, we want to, AM560 along with Signature Bank, want to give a local business a marketing package that is valued at $75,000. Not $7,500, $75,000. We want you to use this boost to get your business back on track or take it to the next level. All you have to do is tell us how you've overcome the challenges of this last year and how this business boost could help you. So to enter, go to 560theanswer.com/boost. That's 560theanswer.com/boost. Terms and conditions apply, and entries must be submitted by August 1st. And this is presented by Signature Bank.
I wonder if I move my business to Indiana is how I coped. It will be a good
submission. A lot of
submission.
People did.
I will have to ask Brian Duncan from Signature Bank at the top of the next hour if that qualifies. I just got it finally picked up and left and went to a place where the cost of doing business is a fraction of Illinois. This whole $8 trillion and change spend over the last year is just one big rolling catastrophe, isn't it? We talked about this yesterday. Depending on whose expert estimates you believed, $200 to $400 billion worth of the COVID relief stolen. Stolen by foreign criminal syndicates and with a little bit of help from our local street gangs in this country. $200 to $400 billion, nearly 50% potentially of the COVID relief, individual COVID relief conferred through unemployment and so forth, stimulus checks, stolen.
And not peeps, crickets from the mainstream media. No one is talking about it but this station.
Sidelining employees who would otherwise be at work because you're paying them more to stay home. And Casey Mulligan, University of Chicago, and his colleague E.J. Antoni, an economist at Texas Public Policy Foundation, have a good write-up in the journal. 21 states in D.C., households can receive the wage equivalent of $25 an hour in benefits with no one working. No one working. In 19 states, benefits are the equivalent of $100,000 a year in salary for a family of four with two unemployed parents. So that's not good. And this against the backdrop of lockdowners destroying, wiping out 40% of small businesses in this country. And also not delivering for people they did promise to deliver for after shutting them down. For example, Pagliacci Schumer made a big show of the money needed to bail out live music theater, live music venues and other art houses.
Oh, yeah, that's right. A few weekends ago, he was on a corner at some street festival saying, we need more of these and we're going to help you. I promise we'll get you the funds.
Promise to bail out Broadway, you know, yeah. Seeing as he's from New York. And, I mean, I'm the same way. Sure, all the cultural institutions in Illinois shuttered as well, despite the fact that, you know, they're most inclined to be acolytes of the Democrat socialists. So they're difficult to countenance their hypocrisy, but nonetheless, they were unfairly shut down just like any other business. $16 billion federal grant fund intended to preserve music clubs, theaters, other live event businesses devastated by the pandemic. But as our friend Jim Freeman writing the Wall Street Journal notes, fresh obstacles, including the discovery that the government thinks they're dead. It was the latest bureaucratic mishap for the Shuttered Venue Operators Grant Initiative, this aid program created by Congress late last year that has struggled at nearly every turn to disperse badly needed relief funds. We're 16 months in. Bob Hansen, the managing partner of Bobby McKee's, a piano bar near Washington, received a cryptic email Tuesday afternoon that began, "Your name appears on the do not pay list with the Match Source DMF." A few minutes of frantic Googling revealed that was a reference to the government's death master file, a record of more than 83 million people whose deaths have been reported to SSA, Social Security Administration, except for the problem that Bobby McKee is not dead. But his piano bar is going to be if he doesn't get the funding that was promised. Michael Swire, founder of Bowery Ballroom and Mercury Lounge in New York, and a prominent figure in the independent music world, also received notification that he is considered dead. Except he's not dead. As James Freeman asks, is it time to kill a federal program that can't seem to provide help to the living? Can we have federal programs meet that standard? The only help to the living it provides is for those who want to be dependent on the state, it would seem. For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by Steve Malanga, contributing editor of City Journal, senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute. Steve, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure.
Well, you've written a piece about the American stagnation plan and all this money that's sloshing around, as we were describing. And you have, you know, sort of more anecdotes that speak to this chaos that I'm referencing generally. Here's one of my favorites. The city of Detroit plans to use the funny money they got from the feds, $400 million of it, to eliminate intergenerational poverty. You know, Steve, the first $30 trillion over the last 50 years, that didn't work. But this $400 million, that's going to make the difference.
Well, in particular, of course, because specifically what they don't have any good ideas. The first thing I thought of when I read this is, well, you know, we've been trying this since the 70s. This is really even what the Great Society was about. And the first thing I thought of is, well, gee, what kind? Do they have some kind of new ideas, new programs? And as you read about it, what you find is they don't have any ideas. They're going to go to the communities and ask the communities, how should we spend the money?
The most expensive listening tour in American history. Right. Yeah, of course.
Yes, exactly. So you know, one of the things that I focused on in my piece was what cities and states were doing, because they're receiving $350 billion. Now, they had complained from the beginning of the pandemic that because their tax revenues were going down, they needed money for their budgets. Trump never gave them money for their budgets. He gave them money for mass transit and things like that. But he said, I wasn't going to help budgets because, frankly, some people are in trouble with their budgets because of their own problems. Nonetheless, what we saw is the tax revenues came back very, very quickly. Even so, however, the Biden administration handed $350 billion to states and cities. It's so much money that California now has a $70 billion budget surplus, and they're using some of the stimulus money to simply give money back to Californians. Okay. Now, the irony of this is that the enhanced employment benefits, as you were talking about, are paying people essentially not to work. It's a disincentive to work because the benefits are so good, why go back to work? All right, so what does the Biden administration do? They extend the unemployment benefits, those enhanced benefits, all the way to September. Meanwhile, cities and states start asking them if the money that Biden is sending them, they could use some of that to give bonuses to workers to get them back to work, unemployed work people, to get them back to work. So on the one hand, we're paying unemployment benefits, which are so good that people don't want to get back to work. And on the other hand, we're taking other stimulus money and saying, well, if you go back to work, we'll give you a bonus. Well, what about all the people who went back to work just because their jobs were there and they thought it was the right thing to do? They never got a bonus.
Suckers.
Suckers. Can we get paid on the other end?
But is that
going to even work? Is that going to even be enough to get people back to work?
Well, it's $1,000, basically. It's a very good question. So, you know, I'd ask you the question. Here we are in June. You have three more months to get the enhanced unemployment benefits that the feds are offering, together, of course, with your state unemployment benefits. Yeah. Right? You can just do that, no questions asked. Would you take that, or would you take a job plus $1,000 extra in your pocket from the government? It's a good choice.
I'm going to go with option one. Yeah, enjoy the summer. Relax, spend some time with the kids.
You also get paid more over those 3 months than the one-time $1,000 payment. So it's not just Stockton, California, and the state of California. Cities like our fair city of Chicago, $30 million to give monthly incomes to 5,000 low-income families as a form of disaster relief. And I'm not talking about the disaster that is Chicago's political class. I'm talking about, again, this is one of the places for COVID money. So in addition to, here we go again, to all of the transfer payments and all of the benefits that have been layered in, now $30 million to be spent on 5,000 low-income families in Chicago, and this is happening elsewhere.
Right. And so this is basically the latest thing on the left, the latest progressive idea, and that is universal basic income. Except it's really not universal. It's only being targeted at lower income. Now, conservative economists, including Milton Friedman, once proposed this as an idea: give everybody a basic income and get rid of the whole poverty bureaucracy. No more poverty programs. Just everybody gets a universal basic income. And then there's really no excuse after that, you know. But this is not what this is. This is money on top of everything that we're giving people now. And the idea is that somehow or another, this will make people feel more secure and get them back into society. The problem is we know from welfare and from welfare reform that this money can be a disincentive to get back into society, to go back to work, for obvious reasons. And probably the greatest anti-poverty program of the last 50 years was welfare reform in the 90s, which required people who were able-bodied to go back to work, rather than getting benefits for life. And the number of people who got back in the workforce because of bipartisan welfare reform was probably the biggest leap we've made. Now we're doing the exact opposite. We have gotten back to programs that are essentially disincentives to work. And that's a big problem. And, you know,
we're all just members of Oprah's audience now. You get a transfer payment and you get a transfer payment and you get a transfer payment. That's where it's at. And, you know, the thing, going back to your piece, too, this is great, because what was the argument for this bailing out of state and local governments? You know, they were crushed during the pandemic. If we don't provide this relief, they're going to have to, you know, heaven forbid, have to start laying off workers. Services are going to suffer.
Firefighters.
And then you find the state of Connecticut wants to spend $15 million to send kids for free to museums, aquariums, and zoos this summer. Yeah, right. A real budget crunch there in Connecticut. You got $15 million for free passes to zoos and aquariums.
Exactly. And frankly, you know, I vividly remember, I'm old enough to remember, you know, the 70s and the 80s when, you know, essentially what happened was the federal government said, again, this actually started under Nixon, you know, all of that Johnson administration, Great Society money. Well, we're not sure it's doing any good, so we're going to give it to local cities and states and let them decide how to use it. And you got a lot of just this kind of program. And there's no evidence that the actual, you know, point of these programs was to reduce poverty, you know, that they ever had that effect. And we've even stopped judging them that way. Oh, this is a nice thing, we're going to send kids to museums and stuff like that. But does any of this have any impact actually on reducing poverty? And so really, states are just, they've got so much money that they're just throwing it around. And they call this stimulus now, because the Biden administration is now called the so-called rescue plan, the American Rescue Plan, a stimulus to get the economy going.
Of course.
It's hard for me to see where the stimulus is in a lot of this stuff.
Yeah, but it's not to reduce poverty. It's to buy votes. That's, the dirty little secret, but which shouldn't be much of a secret after 50 years of doing this, but it's surprising to a lot of people still. Steve Malanga, contributing editor of City Journal, senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute. Thanks as always, Steve. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Take care.
Thank you, and he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Before you see it on TV, share it on Facebook, or read about it in the paper, hear it here first. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Dan and Amy coming to you live from Signature Bank at their world headquarters in Rosemont this morning. And you know, a lot of people ask, where did this woke culture and these woke humanoids come from?
Yeah, where?
And J.P. Sears did the work, so we didn't have to. J.P. Sears explaining the evolution of humankind into woke humankind.
Hi, welcome to the Science Channel. From an evolutionary perspective, woke people are the strongest, most capable form of hominoids history has ever seen. They're superior human beings. I'll explain what makes the woke apex predators on top of nature's food chain, but first, you have to understand, woke people didn't just appear overnight. In simple terms, evolution is what we do at a genetic level to win the competition of survival against other forms of life in nature. Now, evolution takes time, so to take a look at the woke's earliest human ancestors, we need to rewind the clock back about 10 years to the pre-Paleo-Wokolithic era. Back then, you had a primitive people known as Homo sapiens. These were a type of hominises who survived using primitive skills such as strength, bravery, intelligence, and productivity. And interestingly, their species only had two genders. Then midway through this era, just after the world ended because of climate change according to Al Gore, the Homo sapien developed into Homo sapien justicus, or commonly referred to as social justice warriors. They were the first pre-woke ancestors who originated online hatred. It's believed they understood fire, and they also learned how to make weapons out of keyboards. And they began mating primarily with their own hands while staring at computer screens. That led us to the current Paleo-Wokeolithic era that created the conditions for the Homo sapien non-binary Woketicus to develop and thrive, or commonly referred to as the woke. They're a very advanced phylum of people who have evolved to shed what are now unnecessary prehistoric qualities like gills, large canines, and self-responsibility. And along with developing the ability to have an inability to tolerate even the slightest bit of discomfort, they've also evolved to develop 72 genders. Now, when we've studied the fossilized evidence of primitive people, we've discovered strong evidence that suggests they did all their thinking in their brains. Whereas the woke carry around additional brains in the form of devices like phones, tablets, and TVs, which is where all their thinking comes from. Darwin's theory of evolution is survival of the fittest. Yet to better understand the genetic development of the woke, our scientific analysis of stool droppings from Hollywood celebrities, along with carbon dating Molotov cocktail shrapnel from downtown Portland, has proven that what's more true than survival of the fittest is survival of the outraged. Whereas those who archaically lived peacefully, productively, and lovingly have simply died off because they weren't fit to survive. When learning about the woke, it's best to think of evolution as a spectrum. Intelligence evolved into outrage. Freedom evolved into obedience. Love evolved into hate. And self-responsibility evolved into socialism.
And here we are. Thank you, J.P. Shears, for putting the work in on the evolution of the woke in this paleo-wokeness era.
It's like a hot, steaming cup of information to start your day. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Mike Manapkin runs the Democratic House floor for 30-plus years running. He's promising this and he's stealing that. Where can you get that kind of money? He's using your house like his own piggy bank. You ought to know by now. You can pay off your house here in Illinois, but you can never keep up with the taxes. Oh, how it's always been the plan to have a taxpayer pay no doubt. Not a matter of if anymore, but when you're moving out.
Dan and Amy, coming to you live this morning from Signature Bank in Rosemont, their world headquarters, launching our Signature Bank Business Boost joint, which we'll talk to Brian Duncan from Signature Bank at the top of the hour more about. By the way, the...
I don't have a business to boost, but I want to get one. Can you hear me?
No, I don't hear you. I don't know. Can we... you need to turn your microphone on so the people out there can hear you. Okay. Well, I don't. It's a technical workshop here. With respect to the author of that song, the songwriter and the singer, Tim O'Donnell, he's left Illinois. And by the way, he sent me another song, so we'll have to review that and see if it's airworthy.
Okay.
Oh, there you go.
There you go.
Oh, there you are.
Did he take out Mike Madigan?
No.
Okay.
No. I'm not. It's a whole other topic here. He's expanding his oeuvre. So we'll get to that. But as I understand it, despite the fact that we lost one Congress being, Jelly Belly is saying that people aren't really leaving Illinois. It's not a big deal. Everything's fine. There's nothing to see here.
It's great. We're reopening. Great. Phase 5 Friday. Woo-hoo!
So let's check that with Ted Dabrowski, president of Wirepoints, wirepoints.org. Ted, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Good morning, Dan. Good morning, Amy.
Is that right? You know, a few people leaving, sort of the natural attrition, people retiring to the Sun Belt and so on and so forth. But all of this loose talk from hysterics like me and you about an exodus, that's just not true.
That's right. Look, you know, we've seen many places who can just grow their way out of problems just by shrinking. No, I'm kidding. It's really hard to have a really robust economy and thriving economy and people, you know, earning more and having more opportunity if you don't grow. and Illinois shrinking, one of the three states that shrunk over the last decade, and yet Pritzker and his press speaker are trying to just cover that up and say, hey, don't worry, you know, things weren't as bad as we thought they were. We still shrunk, but just not as much, and that's just bad, bad thinking, and it's, again, one of the ways of kind of pulling the wool over Illinois' eyes, on like the budget and everything else.
Give us your, since we just concluded another regularly installed session of the General Assembly, give us your top line, give us, you know, your summary in 90 seconds or less of what people should take away from the recently concluded session.
Well, first of all, it's not over yet, right? They're back, and so they're back to do more damage, and we can talk about that energy bill and other things. But the overall thing is that it's going to be more expensive to live here. There's more corruption. They didn't solve any problems. And I can't help but say it. Life will be worse overall, with the exception of all the bailouts that came from the federal government. Life will be overall, when that free money, when that largesse is gone, that free money is gone, it will be more expensive to live here, and the opportunities just won't be as good as they are elsewhere.
And the only thing left to do is ban coal-fired plants and put a school board, elected school board in Chicago, right?
Yeah, I was hoping that the bad news is over, that the damage that we would be saying that the legislature has done is finished. But they're back this week, and what's left are two big things. But that energy bill is massive, and if you're worried about corruption, and if you're worried about, you know, the kind of mess that the Illinois legislature can make, this is it right here. Massive subsidies for nuclear, increased rates for people. But what's amazing about this whole thing is it's the green push, and you know the green lobby wants this new deal so bad, this new energy deal so badly, because it will have massive amounts of construction of you know, new energy, closing of coal, and that means all kinds of construction and prevailing wages, which means union wages for government workers, project labor agreements. So everything will cost a lot more, and you know, ordinary taxpayers will be paying for it.
And are they trying to close nuclear plants as well?
Well, no, there's a threat. You know, Exelon's threatening to close two or three of the plants. They say they don't have enough money, and so that means ratepayers, ordinary people, need to pay up and pay for it. And that's what they're demanding.
You know, what's the state of mass transit? Speaking of money pits, and how is that going to be financed long term if you don't see a real return in ridership?
Well, that's going to be the big question for the big cities, including Chicago, and we're going to have to see whether, you know, what happens to a place like Chicago. There's still tons of money flowing from the governments, federal government as well, to mass transit, and you know, like the Metropolitan Transit Authority in New York got $4 billion during the crisis from that Fed facility that Illinois also borrowed from. So you're going to see them pour tons of money to support it, but you know, the question is there going to be enough ridership? Are there people going to trust the system, or are we going to have enough people living in Chicago and the denser cities to make that work? I don't know, but you can expect the subsidies to kick in more and more and more.
I want to do a thought experiment with you. I did this on Twitter over the weekend. I was surprised from those who responded how anemic the responses were. Nobody really challenged the premise very much. And the question is this: how would Illinois be different if all 177 members of the General Assembly were Democrat socialists, rather than having super minorities of Republicans in both chambers? If you just eliminated them all, 177 Democrat socialists, would Illinois be any different?
No, I don't think so. You mean we didn't have Republicans, we just had Democrats?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I don't think it'd be that different. I mean, you've got a handful of Republicans who I think are really good at pushing back, but they're just a handful. They're not enough, so from a voting perspective, it wouldn't be any different, and their voices aren't heard either. They're, you know, the Republicans are the ones that, who do speak up, are shut down. So I don't think it'd be that different. There is no, and yeah, I'm still looking for that platform from the Republicans. What is their platform to make them different from the Democrats? They need to be bold, speak up, but until they do, Dan, your question is a good one.
Mm. We're speaking with Ted Dabrowski, president at Wire Points, Inc., and Ted, what is the future? I heard that there may be a third version of House Bill 2789, which would give Pritzker and the IDPH control over private and religious schools.
Oh, that's a big one. There's been pushback on that. It's I want to hope that, you know, as you see more and more parents speak up, that thing dies in some way, but you can bet they'll continue to push it. You know, right now we've got the big mask, trying to remove the mask mandates in schools and things like that, which is, of course, republic. But, you know, I'm happy that I see more and more people pushing back on that. And so does that extend into stopping IDPH from controlling private schools? God knows in this state. Right now we're in a, as I've said before, the pendulum is swinging grossly against, let's call it the freedom movement and the reform movement. But how far does it go? I wouldn't be surprised if IDPH does try to take over control of the private schools in that sense. It shouldn't surprise anybody.
Well, speaking of masks, do you have any suggestions for, there's a group of moms, we want to do something to try and get our kids free from masks next fall. Any suggestions for us?
Leave the Chicago public school system.
Can't do that. We wish we could, but we can't because we have these things called ex-husbands. But also, our kids, when they're a certain age, you know, when they're 18, you can't really tell them, oh, you're going to transfer to this school. And you know,
are they 18?
They're going to be in a few months they're at school. So,
yeah.
But what can we do, Ted?
Well, you know, we put the data out there at Wire Points, and it's, you know, data doesn't really matter these days, but that's the only thing we got to hang our hat on. And we put the data out there, and it's a slam dunk that masks aren't needed in schools, you know, period. When you look at the safety of children, there's only 19 children who have died from COVID. It's far riskier to go for kids to ride their bikes or cancer, or there's a lot of other things that have killed many more kids.
Car accidents,
COVID
drowning.
Has. Car accidents, yeah. And then 83% of elderly are vaccinated. So, you know, we've gotten to a situation where the people that need to be protected are protected, and the kids have no risk, so let's go. And we just got to keep making that argument. And I see moms getting together and being strong. I don't know if it's going to work at CPS, but I think at some of the other public schools it will. But it's going to take that continuous fighting, and I see the fight in a lot of moms, some dads, and you just got to keep going at it.
Now, looking for a sign of a pulse in the Illinois Republican Party, Don Tracy, who's the newly minted chairman, he's a lawyer from Springfield, and a successful businessman, family business. He posted a piece at Real Clear Politics that actually does something I haven't seen an Illinois Republican title holder do in a long time. It actually tackles our cultural issues here. And specifically that sex education legislation, the Democrat Socialists moved, that focuses, imposes an elementary school curriculum focused on instruction about the full range of sexuality, sex acts, gender perception, and so on and so forth. For example, kindergartners will be taught about consent and distinctions between sex assigned at birth and perceived gender. Third graders will learn about the ability of hormone blockers to forestall puberty and so on and so forth. And Tracy has actually taken this up. You know, it seems to me that, and this is a sort of a quasi-policy and political question, you know, if you don't take up these issues of that are curriculum-related in K-12 education when it comes to this identitarian agenda, both in terms of critical race theory and things like this coursework that I'm describing, then you're just not relevant to the conversation because that's where the fight is.
Well, you're absolutely right. And, you know, it's some places, you know, like at Wire Points, we were trying to talk about the finances. But the finances don't matter if the culture doesn't matter. And, you know, we saw that with COVID, and it overtook any, you know, who cares about finance? It's all about COVID and control. When you talk about schools, who cares about finance? It's all about this culture. And so you're absolutely right. And, you know, I think Don Tracy got some support from the polling that was done by Ogden and Fry the other day that said 70-80% of Illinoisans oppose that stuff. And I think that's what we're forgetting. Sometimes, you know, the press in Illinois is dominated by the left. You got the courts. You got the legislature. We forget that the ordinary Illinoisans, a lot of them are just either quiet, can't keep up, don't know. But when pressed on issues like this, these sex ed, and you know, and I encourage every Illinoisan to go look at the details of the sex ed. It's extreme. It goes so far that you know, when they do polling, 70-80% of Illinoisans oppose it. So the Republicans can start to look at some of these reactions by ordinary people and say, okay, hey, we can speak up about cultural issues. Do it in a smart way, right? Do it in a whatever you want to call it, reason and logical way, because you know, eventually the arguments will win out against these extreme laws.
It's been remarkable to me for I don't know, the last 25 years I've been in Illinois politics or in and around it, which is they take extreme positions that are unpopular. They do not speak about it reasonably. It's just all demagoguery and name-calling. And the Republican Party leadership, as it's been constituted over that time period, is consistently cowered by that approach. It is one of the reasons why Illinois is the worst governed state in the country and why you're looking for a pulse in the Illinois Republican Party, because, frankly, it is a party full of cowards and the complicit, those who are interested in the spoils of war, getting cut in on the action in Springfield, these pathetic surrender Republicans that have been charged with the party for so long. So for those who are looking for a fight, looking to take up the fight on these matters of conscience and substance with respect to K-12 education and on so many other fronts, if you can't present a compelling leadership team, then you're not going to have any seat at the table. You're not going to be successful. And that's, to me, why the Republican Party hasn't been successful, and it will continue to not be successful.
Yeah, Dan, you know, what I've noticed in the whatever 12, 13 years I've been doing this is that they always want, you know, Republicans have wanted a seat at the table, despite the fact they're a minority all the time. They want a seat at the table, and by being at the table, they end up joining in on bad deals, bad laws, bad policies, thinking they made them a little better. Well, they get no credit for making bad deals a little better, and so, you know, the Democrats have continued to get bigger and bigger majorities over time, and they still think that they should follow that same policy. Well, I think instead they should be more principled, you know, lay the law down for what they believe in, you know, sell that message to the public and see if they can create a real second party in Illinois, because right now we've only got one party.
He is Ted Dabrowski, president of Wirepoints, wirepoints.org. Ted, thanks as always.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you, and he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Connect with Dan and Amy on the AM 560 The Answer mobile app. Just text the word app to 64636 to download the app today. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, and we're coming to you live from Signature Bank's world headquarters in Rosemont this morning. We're launching our joint with Signature Bank, the Business Boost Program. And we're pleased to have one of the lending lords of Signature Bank, Brian Duncan, with us this morning.
Quite the introduction. Yes.
Kevin Masuga, who's I went to high school with, fellow Bennett Academy alum. He is injured. He couldn't be here. And we know, Brian, it's not a work-related injury.
Well, he's claiming he does most of the heavy lifting around here. So,
sure, of course.
So he had some back surgery, but he'll be okay.
Yes. He'll be fine, yes.
So let's talk about this Business Boost Program a bit. Amy, provide the particulars, would you?
Yeah, so if you own or run a small or mid-sized business and you are impacted by the pandemic and by the lockdowns, and you need a business boost, basically. So what we're offering is a $75,000 marketing package that will be used to boost your business and get you back on track or take you to the next level. And all you have to do is tell us how you've overcome the challenges of last year and how the business boost could help you. So to enter, go to 560theanswer.com/boost. That's 560theanswer.com/boost. And entries must be submitted by August 1st. So you have some time to write your story, but it's needed because what you mentioned too, 40% of small businesses closed
gone.
This past year.
Gone.
Yeah, that's right. We're so proud to sponsor this Business Boost. A lot of businesses out there are still struggling, still recovering from the pandemic. And you know, while PPP and some other government aid programs have done their job, we know it's still a very challenging environment, and we're just proud to help small and medium-sized businesses because they're the drivers in this economy, and they always have been. And the American entrepreneur is very resourceful, but anything we can do to help, we're going to do it.
And how many customers did you lose, or customers that you had that lost their small businesses?
Fortunately, Amy, we had very few. Most of our businesses were able to roll up their sleeves and make ends meet. They were batting down the hatches. And like I mentioned, the PPP program really, really did its job. It helped bridge the gap during the lockdowns. But fortunately for us, our credit quality has held up well. But that doesn't mean that we don't have clients that are currently hurting and that could use a little bit more support. And as a bank, that's what we've been able to do. We've been able to help help them bridge these funding gaps.
And you should tout your own success, too. 100% of the PPP apps that you guys process on behalf of your clients were funded. And so that's huge, especially in the beginning when a lot of the big banks were a little bit lethargic about it and not providing great client services. You guys sort of filled that gap.
Yeah, that's right. I'm so proud of our team and the way we came together to get those loans originated. We funded $370 million over 1,100 loans. And in that 3 or 4 week period during the first PPP round, we funded more loans than we typically fund in 3 years. And it truly was a team effort on behalf of our team here. Everybody pitched in. We had people working from 7 in the morning until midnight. I remember being on a call once at 11 p.m. trying to figure out the process with one of our IT people. It really was remarkable what we accomplished. We were getting calls from clients at some of the larger banks in town that couldn't get a hold of their banker or you know, didn't know the process or how to get things done. And we just took it upon ourselves to figure it out.
And the thing that was cool, too, because I saw the emails, you know, after PPP had receded from the headlines, but there was still funding available in PPP, I mean, up until just a couple of months ago, you guys were still hitting it, making sure people knew that there's still funding available to get if you qualify in your need and there's still assistance available.
Yeah, that's right. That was the round two, and then in round two there was a revenue decrease threshold that you had to qualify for. So only about a little less than 50% of our clients qualified for that PPP round two. So once we got through our existing client base and got them their funding, then we went out and we reached out to other clients that were non-customers to see if we could help get them through the process and they could deal with the traditional bank as opposed to going to a fintech or someone like that to get their funding.
Well, the first round was more prospective because you hadn't felt the real impact of an extended lockdown. And then the second round, as you're talking about with the decrease in revenue qualifier, now you're salvaging businesses because they have felt the impact of the lockdowns over time.
That's exactly right. The round two really again a lifesaver for a lot of these small and medium sized businesses. Hopefully now we've put the pandemic behind us. These businesses are getting back to work and hopefully they got the funding they need to get get the doors back open and get fully back to work.
If some people feel like their big bank has left them, is there still some funding out there that they can contact you?
Unfortunately, no. The PPP program here is for all the community and large banks is over.
And do they have to pay back the loans, or does it depend on the business and how much they lost?
So the payback is based on forgiveness. It's based on how much of the funding went to support employee salary and wages. I think rent expense was also included, and some other overhead expenses could be included in that, interest expense and such. But I would say 99% of our customers are going to receive full forgiveness on the amounts they received from PPP.
What's your handle on the business landscape in Chicago right now, particularly since your sort of center cut is small to medium-sized businesses, and we've read a lot, heard a lot about supply chain disruptions and these industries trying to get back to everything running as efficiently as possible. What you're hearing and feeling from your customers?
Yeah, so what we're hearing over and over again from our family-owned, privately-held businesses is that the pipeline has never been more full, but the supply chain is completely disrupted. Suppliers are demanding 30-day terms when you can get product, and they're only giving 30 to 40% allocation on orders that are made. And then on top of that, most businesses have anywhere between 10 to 20% of their positions, their employment positions, unfilled because they can't find qualified workers to come back into the office or factory.
So what advice do you give them to try and get workers back in?
Well,
I mean, I know you're a bank, but I mean,
right,
try and help them?
And that's probably beyond anything that we can do in terms of helping from a labor perspective. But the one thing I mentioned it earlier is the American entrepreneur is extremely resourceful, and you can put challenges in front of them, and they will figure out a ways to overcome those challenges. And what we're facing right now, I believe a lot of the economists I follow say this is temporary, that this is not some systematic of any type of long-term inflation, that once the unemployment benefits run out, that people will return back into the office and return to work. So let's all be hopeful that it is the case and that this isn't a sign of permanent permanent issues or flaws within our economy.
Well, it's probably not the Weimar Republic quite yet, but, I mean, there is a couple of dynamics. One is the supply chain and the bottlenecks. But obviously, I mean, you know this as a banker, is you create $8 trillion out of whole cloth. That's going to induce some inflationary pressure that we're feeling as well.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, keep in mind, though, like the way the PPP program worked, for example, and not all the government programs work like this, but the bank funded that money initially. So that wasn't right. That wasn't, quote unquote, printed money, right?
The government-backed.
Right. The government-backed money happens on the back end once those loans are forgiven. So, for example, Signature Bank, we've forgiven about 50% of the $370 million that we've funded. So there's still about, call it 50% of the total funding in PPP that needs to flow through the system yet. And obviously that is a risk as we move along if that has the propensity to cause inflationary pressure.
Yeah, that's the concern, of course, is that this gets passed on to the consumers and those that are lower in the socioeconomic spectrum and spend more of their money on dirigibles, and it just becomes a stagnant economy, and we know all about stagnation in Chicago.
Well, that's exactly right. Prices will go up, and goods and products and services will cost more, and that is happening in the short term.
Oh, yeah.
It's just a matter of whether it's permanent or not.
In the financial services sector, how robust? Because I mean, financial services really. Chicago, I don't know if you know this, not a meatpacking town anymore.
No.
So financial,
there's a few left.
Financial services, insurance, small to mid-sized manufacturers for sure. But the health of the financial services sector here with all of the pressures that are related to pandemic and lockdown combined with the tax and regulatory pressure here.
Yeah, I think most of the banks here are similar to Signature. The banking system, unlike 2008 and 2009, which was a crash that was caused from the financial sector, this crash or this downturn is not the same. The banks are pretty much in pretty good health. Yes, there's a couple out there similar to us that have a couple, may have a couple problem loans, but those problem loans are more so related to the lockdowns and the hospitality industry and businesses that will come back eventually. So I think the health overall is pretty strong.
Signaturebank.bank is the website. If you want to get more information about Signature Bank, perhaps become a client, and I would certainly encourage that.
And if you want to have a chance to win $75,000, a marketing package boost for your company, go to 560theanswer.com/boost.
Brian Duncan, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it. And
thanks
hosting us.
Yes, thank you.
Happy to host, and thanks for being here.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Your show keeps me alive during the week. There's nobody I'd rather listen to between 5 and 9 in the morning than you guys.
On AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, broadcasting live from Signature Bank in Rosemont, as you heard us talking about with Brian Duncan from Signature Bank just a moment ago. Wanted to get this in. Tony Fauci, his storied career, Dr. Tony Fauci. This is an interview from Tony Fauci by ABC News in 1983.
Ooh, going back in the time machine. I love it.
On AIDS transmission. And listen to him talking about AIDS transmission and see if you don't pick up on sort of an approach to a discussion on disease that is reminiscent of the approach that we've seen from him over the last year.
Well, for example, if the close contact of a child is a household contact, perhaps there will be a certain number of cases of individual who are just living with and in close contact with someone with AIDS or at risk of AIDS who does not necessarily have to have intimate sexual contact or share a needle, but just the ordinary close contact that one sees in normal interpersonal relationships. Now, that may be far-fetched in the sense that that there have been no cases recognized as yet in which individuals have had merely casual contact, close albeit, with an individual with AIDS who, for example, have gotten AIDS. For example, there have been no cases yet reported of hospital personnel who have fairly close contact with patients with AIDS. There have been no case reports of them getting AIDS. But the jury is still out on that because the situation is constantly evolving and the incubation period is such so long. As you know, it's a mean of about 14 months, ranging from 6 to 18 months. So what medical researchers and public health service officials will be are concerned with is what we felt were the confines of transmissibility now going to be loosening up and broadening up so that something less than truly intimate contact can give transmission of this disease.
You see what he did there?
Oh, my God.
You see what he was doing there? It's the same thing. It's sort of 2.0 or maybe 3.0. I'd have to go back and look at his pronouncements from on SARS and Ebola and so on and so forth. But bird flu. What he was doing there? Out of an abundance of caution, let us live in preparation for the worst-case scenario. There are zero cases
of nurses or hospitals.
There's zero cases of what I'm suggesting is possible. There's no cases. But this is what we're looking at. And the next step is to say, out of an abundance of caution, let's lock people down.
And the fear of but then he scares you, the fear of transmission at home. If you're living with someone who has AIDS, maybe you can, maybe you can't.
Well, that's my point. Yeah. It's a possibility. It's not happened, but it's a possibility. This is what researchers are looking at. And we just weren't there as a country yet where you were going to have, and thus we should lock it all down. This terrible public policy evolves over time. It continues to get worse when you're starting from the an abundance of caution. Not the most reasonable, the most likely, but the worst case. That was a preview, foreshadowing, really, of what he would be saying some 3.5 decades later on COVID, isn't it? I just not to mention that he was wrong. Instead of saying, here's what we know, here's what we understand, here's where we're at, and, we're keeping abreast of all possibilities. We're continuing to monitor. We're continuing to do more research. Rather than throwing out these worst-case scenarios that implicate all sorts of potential public policy responses, even though there's no basis to believe that they're true. That is passive-aggressive fear-mongering, what you heard from Tony Fauci there.
And he's doing the same thing decades later.
Well, in 2021, in 2020, in 2021, it just became, just remove the passive. It's just been straight aggressive fear-mongering from Fauci and his ilk.
If you're talking about it, Dan and Amy are talking about it. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, coming to you live from Signature Bank in Rosemont, kicking off our business boost promotion joint initiative with Signature Bank. And Amy, I got a text from a friend of mine that read the following. If friends made vaccination, kids too, a condition of visiting their lake house for a weekend, what would you do? What would be your response?
Ooh. Well, my kids and ourselves are vaccinated, but I would not go. That's not, that's, first of all, friends, should friends even be asking friends to see if they're vaccinated?
Friends don't let friends go to lake houses unvaccinated. My response was, tell those fear-addled ignoramuses to go make love to themselves by way of making it clear we're not friends anymore.
Okay. Well, there's your answer.
This is an opportunity to prune your friend circle, I would suggest. Now, of course, that's easy for me to say with a very small friend circle.
Right. And sorry for interrupting, but that's what America's become. We're now snitching each other out. We're still giving each other the stink eye. If you're not wearing a mask in a store, we're asking stupid questions like that and putting parameters around visits to lake houses. Is this the America you want? I want to get back our country.
Well,
and I want to get back our school system to normal. I want to get back control of my children.
Those lake house minders, though, must have been listening to Andy Slavitt, the outgoing Biden COVID czar, who was on CBS the other day pitching his book.
Yeah, somebody else profiting off the pandemic.
His book, Preventable. And you know what the problem is? After 40% of small businesses have been eviscerated, a year and a half of school for K through college has gone.
Families have been destroyed. Do you know how many divorces there are? Just wait till those numbers come out.
And all of the other consequences of lockdown policies, in the face, by the way, now of studies from MIT, from the National Academies of Sciences, from University of Munich, that suggests that, the lockdowns had little or no impact on transmission. Huh. Andy Slavitt, top line takeaway, the COVIDians rewriting of history didn't sacrifice enough.
Could have done
I think
better
we all need to look at one another and ask ourselves, what do we need to do better next time? And in many respects, being able to sacrifice a little bit for one another to get through this and to save more lives is going to be essential. And that's something that I think we could all have done a little bit better on.
So when we look in the mirror and evaluate our own role in all this, the public, how we could have sacrificed more, as you say, and we think about the possibility of a difficult fall or winter or a difficult variant, what more needs to be done now to prepare ourselves as a public, putting aside the government and the scientific part of this? For us as the public, what's the message?
Well, there's a couple simple things. One is that all the people that for so long live so close to the edge, that don't have a great safety net, that don't have great health insurance, but they're forced to work day in and day out to serve us. They're growing crops. They're delivering food to our warehouses. They're working in grocery stores. They're delivering food to our door. All those people are at risk all the time. And so there's a chapter in the book called The Room Service Pandemic, and it talks about how a lot of us had it quite okay during the pandemic and others didn't. So we should be looking at that. And then, look, preventing the spread of the disease is really about a couple simple things. Not breathing near one another in large spaces. That's really it, if you want to be overly simple about it. And that requires a certain amount of sacrifice and change. It's a short period of time, and none of us can do it forever, and it's not pleasant. But when we do, we reduce the amount of spread pretty dramatically. And if the variants come back in the fall, as they will, the people who are unvaccinated really are going to need to pay serious attention to that and consider getting vaccinated, because we have some...
It's you, Dan. He's talking to you.
Welfare state, more particular care in abiding the lockdown strictures, and get vaccinated.
And don't breathe in large spaces. I mean, you should do more. Hold your breath longer.
Transmission, as I understand it, mainly in confined spaces among people who are locked down in their homes. But okay. You know who Slavitt reminds me of? He reminds me of Obama architect Jonathan Gruber. Who, famously basically said, we can't, the American people are too stupid to understand what they need, which is why we have to lie to them about Obamacare. That's sort of, Andy Slavitt is sort of cut from that cloth. And again, he's not the only one in the West trying to gaslight people about lockdown policy. Listen to what Bojo over in Britain had to say at the G7.
We've all been going through the most wretched pandemic our countries have faced for our lifetimes, maybe longer, much longer. And I actually think this is a meeting that genuinely needs to happen, because we need to make sure that we learn the lessons from the pandemic. We need to make sure that we don't repeat some of the errors that we doubtless made in the course of the last 18 months or so. And I think what's gone wrong with this pandemic, or what risks being a lasting scar, is that I think the inequalities may be entrenched. And we need to make sure that as we recover, we level up across our societies and we build back better. And building back greener, and building back fairer, and building back more equal, and... in a more gender-neutral and perhaps like a more feminine way. How about that, apart from anything else?
Did he get all the woke buzzwords in?
Yeah, equity,
pretty good
equality,
job.
Feminism, greener.
Strung those together nicely. You know, we got to build back better in a gender-neutral kind of feminine way.
In a greener way, too.
Is feminine and gender-neutral, are they antonyms? For more about building back in a more feminine way, pleased to be joined by David Marcus, New York correspondent for The Federalist, Federalist.com, contributed to the New York Post. Don't buy Andy Slavitt's book, buy David Marcus's Charade, The COVID Lies That Crushed a Nation. David, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Building back in a more equitable, fair, green, feminine, gender-neutral kind of way.
Yeah, don't be selfish, all right? Just stop breathing in large spaces and put a dress on, all right?
What's so wrong? What's so hard about that?
Yeah, that's all you got to do.
But he sounded so arrogant, like he didn't even care about the sacrifices real Americans made.
Listening to Slavitt is really kind of amazing. And first of all, it's obviously just an abject lie that had we sacrificed more, we were going to stop the spread of this disease. That's perfectly clear. But what's becoming clearer and is so troubling is that this looks more and more like it was a dress rehearsal. And that the government's going to pull this out of their pocket anytime they want to tell you you're not allowed to go to church, anytime they tell you that you're not allowed to open your business. And it's scary stuff. And you know who benefits is the Chinese Communist Party benefits and Amazon benefits, right? Because what does big tech want? They want you to sit in your house and order stuff online.
And when you say dress rehearsal, you mean that quite literally, as we're discussing. Are you going to have a float in the de Blasio Cuomo ticker tape parade in New York City celebrating their accomplishments during COVID?
I don't think so. I'm curious to see how this goes off. I mean, I don't think we've had a ticker tape parade in a long time.
It's
a bit of an anachronism anyway, because we don't really use ticker tape. But we'll see what they throw down the Canyon of Heroes. But look, I don't have a problem with that. I would like more celebration, right? I would like us to be able to start moving forward and put this behind us. But it seems like every time we try to do that, you know, Fauci or somebody from the Biden administration about some variant from Mars and you can never
have
your
life. Delta. No, now it's the Delta variant. And if kids don't get vaccinated, parents, you stand to, you know, risk your health, your child's health, if you don't get them vaccinated, when there's therapeutics out there that are proven to work. So why the big push for the vaccine? And don't you think that that's why they're pulling out all these variants?
Yes. I mean, look, I actually think that as far as the vaccine push goes, this is just a situation where Biden and his allies have built this narrative. I interviewed for my book Dr. Montes Plowey, who was the head of Operation Warp Speed, back in July of last year. And he was quite clear that once we got to herd immunity, it was get back to normal life. And the other thing that you're not hearing is, okay, so we 70% vaccination rate that Biden wants. That doesn't even include the people who have had the virus and have natural immunity. So, I mean, we're way past all these numbers. And the American people need to be very suspicious of why our leaders won't just let us move on, or at least some of them, right? Some have.
Well,
but Democrats in particular won't.
Well, that's why. So with respect to the Warren Wilhelm and nipple rings Cuomo parade, I'm all for celebrating the carpe diem attitude toward living. But as per Slavitt and Boris Johnson and so many of these lockdown COVIDians, what I see afoot is an attempt to rewrite, paper over, present an alibi for what they did over the last year and a half, not celebrate getting back to living your best life. And this is an opportunity for politicians to be at the front of the parade, pretending that they acted judiciously, if not heroically, during this time.
Yeah, I mean, history was being rewritten in real time. I mean, this is why I wrote the book, right? I was covering the pandemic all of last year for the Federalist and for the New York Post. And somewhere around this time last year, it became clear to me that we were being lied to about things like the infection fatality rate, which studies were already showing was far lower than the doom and gloom that the World Health Organization was putting out there. You know, nonsense of, you know, it's fine for 10,000 people to go to a BLM rally, but you can't go to church outside. So as I saw this happening, I felt like it was important to just start working on a document that turned into this book that shows all of these lies evolve. And maybe even more important than the lies is the deeper question of why. Why does our government and why does our media crave this kind of control over our lives? And that's something that I think the American people are going to have to grapple with for a long time.
Well, speaking of the media, this remarkable piece in New York Magazine, David Wallace Wells, talking about the Wuhan lab leak theory. And he wrote this. Practically speaking, the media as a whole is already there, having moved in just a few weeks quite close to acting as though it's true. A sign that the Trump era of American political epistemology may be mercifully receding, with liberal and center-left publications feeling now much freer to consider possibilities the president had once made functionally unthinkable. So it was functionally unthinkable to consider the Wuhan lab leak theory because Trump considered it. And anything he considered, even if the facts led in that direction, we couldn't consider because why? Because we're journalists?
Or because, no, well, yeah, right.
Or because, as Jerry Baker wrote in the Wall Street Journal, because the mission is the message.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, listen, long before COVID, this was true, right? I mean, the moment that Donald Trump shocked the world by winning the presidency, several major news outlets like CNN, like the New York Times, like the Washington Post, they made it very clear that they had no intention of covering the Trump administration in the way that every other administration had been covered. They were on a mission to make sure that Donald Trump was a one-term president. And in a sort of sick way, their logic makes sense because they really convinced that the most important thing, whether it was in terms of the virus, whether it was in terms of foreign policy, whatever it was, that the most clear and present danger was Donald Trump himself. So any lies that they had to tell, you know, any obfuscation, that was all perfectly fine. That was all towards the goal of getting rid of Donald Trump, who they convinced themselves was a horrible existential threat.
And what are your thoughts on Dr. Fauci and his, did you mention him in your book?
Yeah, you know, I'm worried that readers are going to be a little disappointed because I don't really drag Fauci that hard in my book. I finished the book around December of last year. So that was before a lot of the stuff he's done this year, which has really just been kind of off the wall. But look, I don't blame Fauci the way some people do because, you know, Fauci's job is to be, an expert on the spread of a virus, right? He's a hammer. Fauci doesn't know anything about unemployment or education or suicide rates or any of these things. So the mistake was for our society to put everything in his hands, right?
Yep.
Experts should be on tap, not on top. There's a great quote from 1910 from the Irish writer E. And that's what we didn't do. Like, we needed his advice, but why we put him in charge of everything is a mystery to me. And my goodness, what a terrible mistake it was.
He is David Marcus, New York correspondent for TheFederalist.com, contributor to the New York Post, the book, Charade, The COVID Lies That Crushed a Nation. Pick it up. David, thanks as always for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
You're listening to Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.